Tonic Talk is a weekly dose of inspiration and encouragement from the Tonic Health family and friends on topics such as mental health and well-being. Funded by the National Lottery Communities Fund. I'm Amber Sinclair, and I'll be your weekly host, taking you on a voyage of discovery and inspiration, exploring a wide range of mental health and well-being subjects with weekly guests who will share with us their advice, their knowledge, and maybe some ideas on the day-to-day issues we're all facing in a post-pandemic world. I'm speaking today with a fascinating young lady called Ellie, who is a musician, a songwriter. She's young. Well, I say young. I think that's because I feel old. But she's younger than me. She's beginning her journey in her career, and she has a lot of emotional and mental health experience that she communicates through her music. Good morning. So you are Ellie. I mean, better known as Redwood as an artist, though.
Yeah.
So tell me about yourself. What I mean, you look so young to be. I hear you've been signed recently as well.
Well, yeah, I've got a manager. So yes, I've got a manager. So yeah, I don't know. I'm you're saying I look really young. I know anybody older than mid-20s is going to be really angry with me for saying this, but I feel so old at the moment. But yeah, yes, 23, nearly 24, yes.
Just at the start of your life and at the start of your career.
Well, yes, hopefully it's just the beginning, so we'll see. But so anyway.
Tell me about what you do. What is your career?
So I'm a musician. Sorry, the dog keeps nudging me for attention. I've been doing music for quite a while. I've always really enjoyed it and used to do like stupid lip syncing and dance routines to Seven and stuff when I was a child.
Fabulous.
I've always really enjoyed music and performance and stuff. And yeah, and I've been doing it a really long time and I've really enjoyed it. And yeah, started sort of writing my own songs when I was, sorry, you got the dog's nose in the background.
That's all right. A bit of dog sniffing noise in the background.
He's settled now. So yeah, and then started writing songs probably when I was about 12 or 13. I was going to say,
because as a musician as well, you do start very, very young usually, don't you? Did you start with sort of traditional lessons?
Well, so I started having piano lessons when I was about six, I think six. So I had those for a little while, and then I had those for quite a few years, and then we were all going to secondary school and everything was changing as life does. And so I don't really know, I'd have to ask my mum really, I don't know why lessons stopped, but they just did. But I was kind of, well, I really struggled with reading music for a really long time.
Okay.
But I don't know how to explain it. I could just hear things and play them, and it's definitely I was born with this talent and oh look at me, I'm so wonderful, because it wasn't that. It was you have to keep practicing and you have to, but if you want to do it, if it's something you enjoy doing, then it's not a chore. You just want to do it and you just want to get better because you
sometimes love. Yeah, and sometimes notation is the chore bit of it. Found this because I'm a pianist myself and I teach.
Okay.
And I've got one or two kids who've got a real love of the music, but the notation just keeps bringing them down. So it's always trying to give them other ways to access music. Notation isn't the only way, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I teach piano too.
And
you and I know. It's trying to keep that enthusiasm there, and sometimes you have to choose things they want to play so that the enthusiasm comes back a little bit. But sometimes they choose songs that they want to play, but actually you listen to pop songs and you're like, oh, it's the same four chords or whatever, and that's really easy. But actually they're really well written, a lot of them, and the melodies and stuff like that, they're hard. And when you're saying to children, oh, this piece has got, this bar's got semiquavers in it, and they're like, like, and you're trying to explain how to count semiquavers and how to play the music, and it's really hard. So yeah, I really struggled with the theory side of music for a really, really long time. And I started just kind of working out chords, major and minor chords, just so I could start accompanying myself on piano.
Yeah.
So for a really long time, all I could do was play chords. Like, and I knew how to play most chords because I worked them out, and I kind of had enough of an understanding, I don't know, to try and work this stuff out.
Quite possibly from the basic of your basis of
absolutely
your six, because I say absolutely that to my kids, there are just basic harmonies that you learn, but yeah, by doing it by ear, I mean, it's almost like you're talking about me. It's exactly what I did. I sat down and I tried to work out how to play the Little Mermaid song, and I sung it and tried to work out what that little riff was at the top, and that's where the enjoyment comes, isn't it? It's really
I think so. I think just obviously playing something you enjoy, and I'm playing a lot of things, but there's sort of classical pieces which during lockdown I was like, I'm going to tackle this now, and I'm going to try and get the hang of it.
I did the same, yeah.
But like, it's hard, and I think as adults, you've got that discipline that I think as a child you don't, because you do just want to go out and play and
future games,
But I don't know, we never had that at home. My mum was no, you're not going to be spending any time looking at a screen. Every time we went in a bookshop, every time my parents were like, if you want a book, just tell us, we'll buy you a book. But never allowed a Nintendo or any of this kind of stuff. It wasn't, no.
Do you not think as well, though, that part of your creativity and part of the reason that you are now a writing and performing artist is because you didn't have that other distraction, because your parents actually kept that from you? And in a way, it was, well, what else am I going to do? But you were drawn to it because that became your pastime. And I think a lot of kids are missing out on that now.
Yeah, I think so. And I expect you find this as well with your piano students. You say, oh, can you just practice this, even if you do 5-10 minutes every day?
That's exactly the same.
And then you get the next lesson, you're like, have you practiced? And they're like, no, because I've got this new video game. And you're like,
So
I think you're right, it's kind of not having those other distractions. I mean, yeah, it was, but I think it's just kind of when you, I can't explain it, it's just kind of when you really enjoy it, it's like you can't get enough of it. And I just also, if I'm as a songwriter, if I'm going through something and I might have to write about this, there have been times when I'll be driving and a lyric comes to me in the car and I don't want to actually upset him now I'm on my phone, but I have to, Siri, record this in my notes, blah, 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 because I just think of things, usually when it's really not a good time to be distracted, i.e. driving. But so I don't know, I think sort of the more you do stuff, and if it's something you enjoy doing, you can't get enough of it. You want to keep at it.
And that's fantastic. That, because I was pretty much the same as you. As I started writing in my teens, but that was when kind of the emotions and changing was starting to happen in my life, and that's what was inspiring me to write. But I definitely found that by 16, 17, and certainly by 18, I'd learned to squash all of those feelings, and I couldn't write anymore. And I think I've written 2 songs since then, and I'm over 40 now. But it was at that time that I was experiencing all those emotions in their rawest form that I could write about it. But there was something in me that stopped being able to access those emotions. But you've managed to kind of keep them flowing and to really access those and keep writing about them.
But I feel too much all the time.
Describe that for me. What do you mean you feel too much?
Just everything. I don't know. I don't know if I'm an empath as such, but I do just kind of everything. If somebody's, I don't know, someone's crying, just if I see a stranger who just seems a bit off, and oh, I wonder what's happened in their day, I should be nice to them, I'll do something nice or whatever. I don't know, but even things like my boyfriend takes the mickey out of me because the Money Supermarket advert where there's the balls in the china shop, And then it's the ball on the scaffoldings falling down the side of the building. And I'm, oh, the poor ball. And now my friend, every time he's like, you think the ball's okay? Every time it's everything. I don't know. There was a bee in my garden last night that was tired and I was going out and checking on it. Poor sugary water, terrible. It's everything all the time. And I think I watched this really deep TikTok video last night.
There's a deep TikTok video?
Yeah. It was this woman talking about how when people sort of are empaths as adults, it's because as a child you were anticipating moods and mood swings of adults around you and stuff like that. I love my parents. I love my family. I'm not trying to do an X Factor sob story, but I am going to play the child card now. It's there. It's on the table.
Right, it's on the table. Thank you.
I've got divorced parents.
Face up.
Yeah. So, and that's, it wasn't easy. It's not easy now. It's fine. I'm all good. But obviously that happened. And I think, because I was 4 or 2 or something when it happened. So when you're that little, trying to process everything going on around you, I think, I don't know, but I think that's kind of,
psychologically. It's far too early in the morning for me to say that word correctly. Third time lucky.
How many coffees are you on?
Oh, I'm on my first cup of tea. This is why. You see, this is why I can't string a sentence together.
Drink tea. Get that down.
I am trying. I did have breakfast, but I'm definitely in need of the caffeine, I think, at the moment. But it's interesting because I was going to say that, but my son he's very similar to you. He'll watch, he thinks everything's cringy. He uses the word cringy to explain it. I mean, he's 11, so he uses a kind of a lot of American terms, but YouTube and stuff, but if he watches a drama or an advert or something where somebody is embarrassed by someone's taking the mickey out of them and they are being humiliated, for example, he can't watch. He feels so embarrassed for them, and it's him that it's happening to. And I'm a single mum, so obviously there's been ups and downs in our life, and he's witnessed it all. Not me, and me at my most vulnerable, but I think I always said it was more healthy for him to see me if I was upset than to hide it, because my parents hiding it was my complete and utter downfall. And I went through awful anxiety and depression. And do you find that, has that affected your mental health in a negative way? Because obviously people can take from what you said. It's a very it's a very positive thing, and that's lovely that there's a bee outside and it's tired and therefore I check it. But that is quite a trivial thing when you look at homelessness, or if you see wars in Syria. I imagine that can have quite a negative effect on you.
One of the things, I am really sensitive, and I don't want to say I always have been, because I don't know, but then at the same time, I don't know, just kind of everything going on and all of that. I mean, it's tough. So your parents are separated as well, or?
No, I've lost both my parents recently, but they were very much, no, but I mean, I was obviously quite a bit older than you, but no, both my parents were determined to shield me from any emotion. And it wasn't they were particularly Victorian, but my mum particularly, even when she was very, very poorly and when she was dying, so stoic, would never tell anybody but maybe that myself when I was caring for her or my sister how she was really feeling, because that was just how they felt it was best to play it. But what happened was that depression, I think, that started to set in. My dad was depressed, and it had gone undiagnosed for so long. I mean, we're talking, you know, the 80s. I think I picked up so many of those bad habits. So it's just a different way that, and again, I wouldn't blame my parents, but it's a different way that they kind of made me up psychologically.
I think also when you're young, and also like there are some people who aren't not observant, but just kind of can't seem to, they just kind of live in their own bubble and they don't really seem to take much notice of anything going on around them. But I think when stuff that is happening, whether it's sort of subconsciously or not, whether we see it happening or not, I think you do kind of absorb what's in the atmosphere. You're kind of,
that's a really good word, absorb. Yeah.
Yeah, you do. I think you do. And I think I kind of, I don't want my parents to be cross with me talking about this. It's fine. I'm an adult
just
now.
Don't tell them about the podcast. It's fine.
My mum knows I'm doing this morning, but I'll be like, what podcast? Huh? My parents, I don't remember a time when my biological mother and father were together. I don't remember that, because my mum basically told my dad she wanted a divorce when I was about 18 months. So he moved out, and I don't remember that. But I do remember just arguments that were had after that. And this kind of, I think, just things. I mean, I watched films, The Parent Trap, where then the mum and dad got back together eventually, or Mrs. Fire. It's a great film, but at the beginning, the mum and dad split up, and it was kind of all of these, not fractured families, but do you know what I mean? These parents who weren't together anymore. It does affect you, and it does affect me. And my mum is with my stepdad, and I call my stepdad dad. He's another dad for me, and I love him to bit. My mum's happy, and my dad's with my stepmom, and I've got a good relationship there, and he's happy, and it's all okay. But it's obviously, I know it's stupid in a way. It's such a, I feel really childish saying it, but it's like your mum and dad not being together. So from all your other friends, oh, I'm doing this with my mum and dad this weekend. And you're like, it is difficult, and it has been difficult. But I don't know, I love my parents, and I want them to be happy. And I think sort of as I've got older and had relationships of my own, I've kind of realised, well, I wasn't happy with this person. Why would I force myself to make it work if it's just not working?
And also, I think it's worth pointing out, Ellie, as well, that there are some children, majoritively children are extremely resilient. And you do have some children that are more affected by this. I mean, my sister and I lived in the same household, and she says to me all the time, my God, we had such different childhoods. How did we have different childhoods? We were in the same house. But it's how I looked on things and what I saw and what I decided to shoulder or to absorb that she then learned to deflect.
Yeah,
I think it is. Not saying that all divorced parents should be held responsible for their children's mental health, but it's being aware, I think, with young people, maybe of personalities and how they do absorb it. And how do you deal with that now? How does that play out in your adult life?
What the
kind of real sensitivity? I mean, I asked you about the negativity that can come from your sort of thought process.
Yeah, it is difficult. I do get very bad anxiety about things. I mean, it can be from, I say, fairly small scale stuff. So for me, small scale is my boyfriend or a family member or whatever says, oh, okay, I'm going out and I'll be back at this time, and they're not back. Or phoned my granddad yesterday, and we were having a laugh about it yesterday, how my granddad, I'll try ringing him and he won't pick up the phone, and I'm like, okay, it's all right, he's just gone to the corner shop, no worries, it's all good. Ring him again, no answer. I'm like, okay, he's probably just gone for a walk in the park, it's okay. Ring him, give it 20 minutes, ring him again, and I'm like, that's it, he's dead. He's dead, and he's on the floor, and no one's there, and oh my God. And it's been in my head. If someone's gone out somewhere, someone's driven out somewhere, and they're not back by the time they say they're going to be, and then that's it, they've had a terrible accident, and something awful has happened. I just get convinced in my head. But then there's larger scale things where someone's having a bad day, and it's completely unrelated to anything you've done. But I honestly am. I sometimes sort of say there's two parts in my head. There's the logical part, the logical side, the anxious side. And my anxious side and my logical side are at war with each other, because the anxiety says, this person's dead, or this person hates you, or no one wants you around, and you should just kill yourself. Sorry, but it is.
Let's not be afraid to say it how it is. I mean, that's what we try and do.
Yeah.
Tonic Talk has been designed to talk about things. I said, please don't be frightened to express yourself, because that's what we're here for. It's what we want people to realise. This is okay. this happens.
Yeah, I think sort of throughout lockdown, there's been so much of it. So many people have been struggling. I think more than anybody realizes, because a lot of people won't admit it.
Statistically, it's the mental health services in crisis from the amount of people that need help.
Yeah, young and that's people just too. People who are actually coming forward and asking for help. Yeah. Because I've struggled, and I've gone to the GP. I think it was sort of 18 or so that I realised I was struggling with sort of depressive thoughts and anxious mm-hmm. thoughts. And I'm not knocking the NHS. I think the NHS is.
Oh, it does some wonderful things.
I think they have been incredible throughout the pandemic, and not just the pandemic, just because it wasn't kind
they
of
save
like
lives, don't they, all COVID. The time?
Well, this is it. And it wasn't COVID happened and every other illness was put on hold. Everything was still going on. So I think they have been incredible, and they've been under an immense strain and all of that. So I'm not knocking the NHS. However, I don't think that, I don't know, but I would, from my own experience, it strikes me that not a lot of GPs are trained and equipped to deal with somebody coming in and saying what to them is an invisible illness. It's not a broken limb. It's not a horrible growth somewhere in the body or whatever, an open wound. It's not. It's someone coming in and saying, pardon my French, I feel shit.
Yeah.
I feel shit and I need help. And that takes balls to come in and do that. It does. It takes immense courage. Yeah, I really struggled. There's been multiple events in my life, but over Christmas, I really struggled with my mental health. And just saying to my sister, this is how I'm feeling and it's bad, that it was, I don't want to sound cheesy, but it was stuck in my throat. It was caught in my throat and I really had to be like, okay, 1, 2, 3, here I go. Because it does, it's like, there's this shame and this stigma that comes with it. We're just saying to somebody, and it is, and it's scary because I did go to the doctor before and I said that this is how I'm feeling. And it took years before finally someone said to me, look, here's this and here's this, and this is what we're going to do to help you. Because for a really long time it was, well, do you think you could go and do talking therapy in a group in Worcester where it's local to me? And I was, no.
I really struggled. I tried the group thing. I think it was an anger management course that they put me on or something like that. And I spent the whole time just in the toilet sobbing because I was just, I can't sit in a room full of people.
No.
At the moment, you know, how can this be appropriate? And the NHS is quite prescriptive.
Yes.
And I think we've spoken about this, that there are GPs. I was very lucky that when I went to a GP, 6, 7 years ago, but even longer than that, that I was very fortunate to get someone, a GP who's obviously supported someone before or suffered herself before with mental illness. And it was an entirely different experience to when I went at 21, which was a long time ago, but I know people are having the same experiences with their doctors. They're being put on, not Prozac these days, but they're being put on a tablet and sort of put on a waiting list and then left. Yeah.
I didn't even get tablets to begin with. Rubbish.
Oh, you missed out there. Yeah, well, maybe they are changing things then. But I mean, if you say I'm feeling suicidal, I feel I want to hurt myself, or I feel I want to hurt somebody else, they know what to do with you.
This is it. But I think when you just go in and say, look, I'm feeling really anxious,
by the time you get to there, it's too late. There's so much damage to undo.
This is it. And it's, it's already bad if you've reached the point where you, because again, also it takes courage to go in, ring up and get the appointment. A lot of my friends who struggle with their mental health, honestly, I have seen one of my friends have an actual panic attack before ringing somebody. People really struggle with this. stuff, and it's not to be sort of ridiculed and things that. And yeah, and I found sort of it took four years or so before I was then, I sort of got the help that I needed. And the GP I went to that time round was just brilliant. He's brilliant. He's still at the doctor's surgery where my mum lives, and yeah, he's brilliant. He's fantastic. We went in, my mum came with me because my mum was like, right, I'm worried about you. I'm going to come in with you.
Yeah.
So at 21, 22 years old, my mum was, come on.
I'll march you down there myself.
Had my mummy come in with me. But he was brilliant, this guy, because I went in and I said, look, this is the situation and this is what's happened. And then he had to pop out the room to take a prescription to the receptionist quickly. And my mum said, oh, I think you should mention that you're a musician. I think you should tell him you're a creative person, because creative people are affected by these things. And actually, it seems to be that creative people are afflicted by this kind of stuff an awful lot. It seems to be the common thread. And I was like, okay, I'll say. And I said, oh, it's my mum thinks it's worth mentioning to you that I have ruined the punchline. It's worth mentioning to you that I'm a musician. And he just went, He's this German guy. He's like, darling, right, have a biscuit. He went and got this tin of biscuits. He's like, take two biscuits. He's like, what are we going to do with you? And all of this. Like, oh, okay.
Oh my goodness.
So yeah, so he was fantastic. But it took a long time before I felt anyone was taking me seriously. And I think it is this, like, because it's an invisible thing. You can't, unless someone sees that you've lost loads of weight and you look crap. People, you look all right, so you must be all right. And you just need to get fresh air and eat more vegetables. And it's like, I walk my dogs twice a day. My mum is vegetable mad, so I'm eating my fruit and veg. It's something else. It's not my diet. It's not my fitness.
The one I really struggled with was there was no trauma. It was endogenous or androgynous, I'm not sure how you say it, but
right.
it's that there's a lot of people, and I think it's really important that we highlight this as well, have this type of depression that isn't trauma based. So while you talk about, okay, there's been difficulties with the adult relationships in your childhood, you can then end up later on just suffering with depression from a chemical point of view in your brain. Something's just not wiring right. And somebody sent me a graphic recently, PET scans, PET scans, a depressed brain versus a neurotypical, someone that definitely doesn't suffer with depression.
Yeah.
And the difference in the colours on the scans show that this isn't made up. This isn't, you can diagnose it with actual science. It's just, we're not quite at the stage where we can gauge how far people are on the scale. It's almost autism, isn't it? It's a very difficult one. We could say we all have autistic tendencies, but obviously then there's a much further along the scale.
Yeah.
And there's a very, very hard process to work with a child to find out where they are and what, and we don't do that for mental health.
No. It is
much more ticking boxes, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely is. It absolutely is. Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. It is, because
it's like you're mentally ill or you're not. You're not mentally ill. You are mentally ill, or you're diagnosed with a mental illness.
Yeah.
But there's that in-betweeny area that you don't really want people to get left in, because then it turns to more severe. Doesn't it?
Definitely, I think so. And I think it's kind of, if people aren't feeling they're getting help as well, then it's kind of, it almost adds to that, well, no one cares and no one wants me around and all of that kind of stuff, because people aren't, sometimes you just want one person almost to say, okay, I believe you and I'm here and I'm here to support you. Yeah. But you can't, I'm incredibly lucky, because my mum's really amazing. I mean, I tell her probably far more than she wants to know, to be honest. my mother.
Bless her.
One of my best mates. I have an incredibly close relationship with my mum. I still call her mummy at 23, 24. And I probably went, yeah, she's incredible. But she's, my mum is brilliant in that if she can see that you are just having a wobble and just being a bit sort of silly, she's very good at gauging when something really is wrong and when you're just being a wally. So yeah. She's like, come on, get up. She's like, come on, we're going to go out. And she's, yes. You know, very good at sort of, right, go and have a shower, put some clean clothes on, put some nice underwear on, whatever.
Put some makeup on, do your hair,
let's go out somewhere. She's great at that. But then also at the same time, when I don't know whether it's just kind of being obviously biologically hers, and she grew me, so I don't know whether we're linked almost, but she's so good at just almost sensing something's wrong before I even have consciously realized something's wrong. And it's no one else in the world apart from maybe my granddad can say to me, are you okay? And I'll go, no. And I'll just burst into tears. She's brilliant. She's amazing. Yeah, I'm very lucky to have my mum.
My mum used to predict when I was having a really bad time of it, but it was usually, oh, you're drinking vodka. What's happened?
Yeah.
And that was the... So I always say now when I get the vodka out, I just warn people around me, you know, if I start on the vodka, there's something bothering me.
Yeah, something's wrong.
You know? Yeah. And it's almost, that's a good... I mean, that wasn't the most empathetic that my mother ever was, but it's a good sign, and it's good to let other people around me know now that there isn't my mum to tell me and remind me. And I don't have anybody close enough that could really see that, but if they wanted to, they'd have heard. And this is going out to everybody who knows me, who's listening, if you see me drinking vodka, there's probably something wrong with me. So how does all this relate to your music? Is your music just an outlet for your emotions, or is it directly about what you've been through emotionally, what you go through?
I don't know. I suppose it's a bit of both, really. I mean, it is an outlet in that if something's bothering me, then I've got, it's how some people keep a diary, a journal, or some people go to the gym, and some people do boxing or whatever. Everybody has a different way, a different sort of coping mechanism for this kind of stuff. Well, I say everybody, not everybody. Well,
no, unfortunately not, but... Yeah. Those of us fortunate to have found one, it's not necessarily going to be music, but yours is. No.
But that, yeah, so, yeah, whenever things have happened, whether it's, you know...
Somebody's given you a...
Heartbroken or...
But it could be... But do you not feel it could be... you sound like the type of person, it could be something as simple as you see somebody, you smile at them because you're them and they didn't smile back, they blanked you.
Oh, yeah, I've had that.
And then you go through that. Oh, God.
Yeah. I'm such a deep thinker, and I think last night when I was cooking dinner, I was thinking to myself, girls I was friends with at school who, when we moved house when I was in year 10, so I just sort of found my little place in school and my little group, and then we moved, so that was not great. But anyway, I had those friends, and they'd said, and I think people say this, don't they, but they said, oh, we'll be friends forever. And when you're young, you're like, yeah, we will. Yeah, that will happen. And then you grow apart. And some people are kind of just accept that. And they're like, well, that's life. And I've got my new friends and I'm okay. But I find every so often I'm still mourning what was.
Yeah.
I think especially over lockdown, where everybody did stop for a second, the world sort of stood still for a minute. You were at home and you were thinking about things. And I there was a couple of songs I wrote over lockdown where I was writing songs about friends that I had and all kinds of stuff that happened at school and what's happened since then. And loads of stuff. There's songs I've written that haven't seen the light of day yet, but songs I've written about friends and friendships lost. Sorry, could you stop sneezing? I'm trying to do something very important right now.
She's talking to a dog, by the way, listeners, not me.
He's lying on his back with his legs in the air. This is something he does quite a bit when he's really chilled. He's really cute.
What's his name?
He's called Brian.
Oh, Brian. What a brilliant name for him.
he's cute. And he knows it. He uses it to his advantage.
Yeah.
So, yeah, loads of stuff written songs about times that have changed and kind of processing my feelings about things that have changed. Yeah, how I feel about the fact that it's changed, that I'm not close with certain people anymore or whatever. Yeah, you kind of, I guess you go through a bit of a grieving process with that kind of stuff, don't you?
I think you do, but it seems to me it's quite a lot to do with where you are mentally and how your outlook on life and things that makes that. So there are probably quite a lot of people listening that just go, well, I don't really have that. And I can't fully understand where you're coming from there. There's nobody from school that I particularly miss or have mourned. And I remember doing that again. I remember doing that when I was younger. But I think particularly as you get older, you do tend to kind of brush those sort of, you go, oh, that's nonsense, and you can maybe brush it to the side. But what's lovely for us in what you do is you keep that feeling and you encapsulate it in a song, in music, so that potentially as well, I would imagine your stuff will be quite, from the few bits I've heard, I've seen a couple of your performances on YouTube, and I've really enjoyed them, and I think you've got the potential for quite a young audience, that pre-18s who are going through all these feelings every day, and that might be, I think that would be really enlightening for them to hear other people talking about this, because I remember as a teenager it all being about love and relationships, and that really wasn't what I needed to hear. What I needed to hear was kind of other stuff that was going on in my life, other emotions that I was experiencing, and I think maybe your music can do that. Maybe that can make them feel, oh yeah, actually that's okay.
Yeah,
to feel like that. There's an adult here who's written about it.
But I think it is. I mean, I kind of, yeah, when I'm feeling depressed, I have a day or so where I do just kind of wrap myself in blankets and sit in comfy clothes and stick something on Netflix or whatever. But then I do get to the point where, and it's kind of this fake it till I make it attitude where I have to just kind of get up and, you know, especially if I'm teaching kids in the evening, I can't sit there looking sad and coming off as sad, because then they're going to say, is everything all right? And I can't say to a child, I'm depressed.
You're having a mental health day today.
Yeah, I don't think I can say that. So I don't feel I can. So I do have to just kind of slap myself in the face. And I hate this expression sometimes, but pull myself together. I know that's a really stupid, I know a lot of people have a problem with that saying. And I think it is an inappropriate thing to say to people.
I think if people as well that are suffering from depression, if that's said in an insensitive or way, or in an this is the answer to your problem way, I think it can be incredibly unhelpful. And to think to pull yourself together and keep yourself together, that's how the phrase was originally. But I suppose what you're saying is, the dog's getting involved, but what you're saying is that you just have to put on a happy face for a little bit, just to function. You know, and that's okay too, because sometimes when you do that, you actually go, oh, actually I'm not quite as low as I thought I was. That's lifted you a little bit.
I think so. And I think another thing I think of, I really like The Lord of the Rings, and I don't know if you've ever read the books or seen the film, but anybody listening to this who has seen Lord of the Rings, they will know what I'm on about. Gandalf is up against the Balrog in this big, I'm really going to embarrass myself now. I think they're inside this big mountain, basically.
I know this bit. Seen this bit.
And he's like, you shall not pass.
Yes.
That I have to, and I tell my friends to do this as well when I'm kind of like, come on, because you cannot let this consume you.
Yeah.
Because you have a life to live, and there are people who love you who, if you weren't around, would be devastated. And even if you don't feel in yourself that you are worth anything, that you are worth
being alive for.
Being alive, you are worthy of having a life. Even if you don't feel that, there are people around you who adore you and would be devastated if you weren't around. I have to sort of say to myself the negative thoughts in my head. I have to pull a Gandalf and I have to say, you shall not pass. I have to get up and be like, no, right, come on. Have those couple of days to feel shit, and then you have to pull yourself out of it, because otherwise it does consume you, and then there's sort of it's a one-way road, you know.
And let's just mention at this point as well that we're not by any means saying that that is possible for a lot of people. We are just talking about your experience, and I appreciate you sharing this with us, because there'll be a lot of people listening who maybe do feel that and who can think, oh, I don't know about this fake it mate to make it.
Yeah.
But that did work for me too in the end. Mm. It was that I didn't believe that anyone cared whether I was here or not, but I had been through therapy and been told, got it written down on bits of paper that there was an evidence that I was worthy of being there. Mm. And I didn't believe it in my heart, but I just kept going back to the evidence. Mm. But I was in a place, because I was on medication and because I was in a talking therapy with a wonderful woman who helped me to, I could access that. I know that you will feel the same way. I feel very, very bad for somebody who can't do that. And I think it's at that point that you need to yell for help very loudly and very quickly, because it is a one-way path. And sometimes you can't help being absorbed by it, and you don't have your inner Gandalf to stop those thoughts, but you need to get someone in there who can.
Yeah.
It's at that point, if you can't, just after, you say, maybe 2 days, to going into maybe 3 days, if you can't then pull yourself, just pull it up, put on a face, get something, move forward. Or if you do it and you still go back to the duvet, you need to seek help.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with that. I feel I should be clear at this point. The Gandalf thing, 9.5 times out of 10 works.
Yes. Okay?
But there have been times where it doesn't work. And I've had to seek more help or whatever, or try something else. It doesn't always work. I just, I find that
it's a lovely analogy, and please don't think I'm taking away from what you've shared, because anything that's what myself and the producer are just so passionate about, speaking to people yourself. And I share a lot of my experiences, because there might be something that somebody hears that works for them. And that's brilliant that you've shared that, because that's going to, even if that just makes one person today be able to get up and just, fine, okay, I will just pull it together, in inverted commas, for just a little bit, and see if I can fake it till I make it, then this is what Tonic Talk is designed to do. So I do really appreciate you sharing it. I'm not trying to take away from that at all, but I think, I mean, people do get into crisis, and have you ever been, this is very personal, but have you ever been in crisis and been able to write about it? Have you been in that situation where you've needed intervention from somebody else, but then been able to actually encapsulate that in a song?
It's kind of one thing that I feel at some point I still would do. I spoke to a school counselor when I was in school, but I never, because when I was sort of 12 or 13, I was having quite a bad time at school and lots going on in my personal life. So I did see somebody then, but apart from then, as an adult, I've not had any sort of talking therapy or anything like that. So actually, when things have been bad, my mum and my sister were the ones who sort of intervened.
They were the intervention. Yeah,
I would have said so. But I think I don't know. I actually, as well, I think my grandfather deserves a shout out at this point as well, because I've got an incredibly close relationship with my granddad.
Is this your mum's dad?
No, this is my dad's dad.
Okay.
Yeah. My mum's parents, I never met them. She was, I think, in her 20s. They passed away. But my dad's dad, who is such a cool granddad. He's one of a kind. There are some things where I think he's 92 now. I think when you reach the age of 92, there are some habits you've got. Some ways in which you're sort of set in your ways, but he's open to change. And if he says something, oh, I think this, I'll be like, oh, okay, but have you ever thought about thinking of it from this perspective? And he'll say, oh, I hadn't thought about it like that. Yeah, no, you're right.
And that's unusual for somebody of that age to be so open-minded. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is the thing. I mean, he's lived through once upon a time it was you could be imprisoned for being homosexual, mm-hmm. or he's lived through segregation of racism, all of this kind of stuff. He's lived through that, and there are some things he says which I'm kind of, oh, you really can't say that anymore, granddad. You're really not meant to say that
anymore. Yeah,
but he's not a homophobe, and he's not racist, and he's just so accepting, and he'll talk to anybody. Yeah, he's brilliant. But anyway, I've gone off on a massive tangent and just started basically saying how much I love my granddad.
That's right. I'm sure he'll appreciate it.
Well, yeah. I only do it for the inheritance, if you're listening, granddad.
Don't joke.
No, I know. He knows I love him. Yeah, so, but no, I've had that support, but it's not come from any professional service or any kind. It's not come from that. It's just, I am, and again, I know how lucky I am to have a family who are there for me.
Well, because you're connected on such a different level than a lot of families do, because I've never been able to say to my sister or my mum or my dad when they were alive, I'm feeling suicidal or I want to hurt myself. It just wasn't something I could share with them. And so you're lucky, Ellie, but you've all made that happen. It's not just luck. That connection and acceptance, which are words that come up every week in this podcast, and I just think it should be our tagline. It's about that acceptance of how you're feeling, your mum appreciating that's how you're feeling, and your sister. Mm. They don't blame themselves. They don't take you to A&E. You're managing it because of the connection that you have. And I think that's really lovely. Have you written about that, your connection with your family?
I haven't actually. I don't think. It's one of those things I think sort of perhaps gets a mention in one or two songs I've written.
Right, yeah.
I haven't written an entire song about it, but yeah, I like, this is again showing my feeling too much side. So obviously, so one of the big bits of news in the last couple of weeks is Taylor Swift re-recording and releasing her earlier works. So she's re-recorded and released her second album, Fearless, and one of the songs on there is called The Best Day, and it's all about the relationship she had with her parents growing up and how she kind of is really grateful to her mum for just kind of loving her almost, and just really, I don't know. And I had it on in the car yesterday and I was just weeping because I was like, I love my mum too.
Oh,
you know? And I think I was listening to the song yesterday. I was thinking, I've got to write about my mum because write about not even my mum, just kind of my family and
acceptance and connection. There you go. See, that's what you're going to write about.
Acceptance and connection.
Yeah. I think that connection is really important, though. So tell me about that song. Can you kind of, because obviously that line kind of shocked me a little bit, but I don't think everybody will maybe listen to that line and think, how refreshing. Let's really read into the story of this. Not everyone's going to do that, but what can you say about the song that would encourage people to listen to it? What?
Yeah, it's basically about how I do get these bouts sometimes for long periods of time, and sometimes it's just a day or just a couple of hours. Maybe I'm bad in the morning and I'm fine in the afternoon, evening. There's no sort of rhyme or rhythm to it, but yeah, I think I'd come home and in the evening, and the person I was dating at the time, he was supportive with the mental health stuff, but I think in a way, I kind of felt I was asking too much of him because I was struggling at the time. I felt like I was almost a burden, and he didn't seem to have it. Was, and this is not to drag him down. I think some people don't have the capacity to deal with this stuff, and that's okay. I believe you have to respect that, and that doesn't mean you're on your own. There are people out there who can help you, but you have to sometimes not go it alone, but sometimes there are some people you can't call on to help, basically,
if your connection's not quite that deep yet,
so I'd basically come home and I was not feeling great, and I just wrote this song about how you can almost, well, sometimes I just wake up and it's one of those days. But sometimes it's kind of the couple of days before where, I'm really crude. Well, not crude, because it's natural. It happens to every woman. But when you're just about, I'm really sorry, guys, if you're listening. When you're just about to come on your period and before it's coming, right?
So, cycle, like, the couple of days.
cramps, nausea, whatever it is that happens to you, it's on its way, right?
Yeah.
And I don't want to compare mental health to periods, but
it does affect your mental health because it is to do with your hormones. And if you already suffer with poor mental health or a fragile mental health, it can rock you one way or the other.
But I think sometimes, every now and then, I can sense when some anxiety or depression is coming, when it's looming. I don't know how to explain it, but
like dark clouds.
Yeah, exactly.
They just start to build up.
Grey clouds on the horizon. Yeah, it is. It's grey clouds on the horizon, and then suddenly they're getting darker and they're getting thicker and heavier and they're rolling closer. It is a bit that. And and I just kind of literally thought of this line, another day, another warning for bad weather, and all of this kind of stuff. And I don't want to spend the next however long dissecting the song because people have not come here to have me.
No, but I think they're listening to it, just kind of that insight is interesting. Yeah. It's going to see a piece of art, I think, at a gallery. If you know a bit more about it, it's has a more profound effect on you.
Yeah, but I think, people may listen to the song and interpret it in their an entirely different way. But when I wrote it, it was just about having these negative thoughts, and really negative thoughts. I don't want it to make it sound my mental health or anybody else's mental health is we put it on for effect or what I mean, or we're attention seeking, anything like that. But sometimes when you are struggling, I think you're in this big ocean. I love my analogies, you can probably already tell
with the weather and the sea, and this is how we think in analogies. This is great.
It's all sort of all one big metaphor, but I think you're kind of in this, sometimes you're in this big ocean and you are struggling to tread water and you're waving your arms trying to get someone to just take notice, someone to just reach that hand out of a little like lifeboat and be like, it's all right, I've got you, are you okay, I've got you, you're all right. And when you feel no one is doing that for you, I just kind of, I don't know, I was writing these lyrics, and I at that point, everything I was feeling, there was a lot going on in my head, and everything I was feeling, it wasn't, to be frank about the sort of the suicide topic, it wasn't, right, that's it, I'm going to kill myself tonight. It wasn't that. It was just kind of, and it wasn't, I wanted to do it to hurt myself. It was, there was so much going on in my head. It was, there was just so much. I just kind of wanted to be numbed to the pain I was feeling and the bad thoughts I was having.
Did you maybe just want it to stop?
Yeah, just wanted to stop. Wanted silence and calm, yeah. Right? So that's where it was kind of not even I wish I was dead. It was almost like I just wish I didn't exist. I wish I had never been
existing the way you're existing, I suppose, as well, feeling the way you did.
It wasn't so much that I wanted to die. It was actually partly because the first line of the chorus is "Do what it's in my head," and dead rhymes with head. So it wasn't like,
yeah. So it's not a suicide song. It's about wanting the world or wanting your brain just to stop.
Yeah, it was. I just wanted that silence, and then. Yeah, and then sort of later on in the song, talking about turning the volume on the radio up, because there were days where I'd drive somewhere, we'd just have to turn the volume up because if I just had the radio up really loud, and it was kind of...
Drowns out some of those thoughts, doesn't it?
It was so loud, it was okay, I have to listen to this noise now. It was almost white noise just to...
I can relate to that, and that's. I wonder whether we could use that song at the end of this podcast. If we wouldn't ruin it for your live performance, take it away from you. But I think there's a lot of stuff in there to make people think, and by sort of summarizing and saying it's not about suicide, it's about not wanting to feel that way anymore and having too much going on in your head. Your analogy of Lord of the Rings, mine was always Dumbledore's Pensieve, and I've said that on a podcast before, that I genuinely felt there were snakes in my head. Each one of them was a negative thought, problem, issue, something that happened, and they were just, it was a cesspit. They were just all fighting amongst themselves, and spaghetti being stirred up in my brain, and I just wish I could just take them out and put them somewhere, because I couldn't cope with them anymore. And I suppose that might be another way that people relate to that noise, and that you don't know what's going on in my head, that please, if I could just open the door and let you see it, you'd see I can't cope with this.
Definitely.
And I definitely related to the song in that way. I really appreciate you being so frank with us, and it's refreshing for somebody, I think particularly younger, to be able to put those feelings into words and into songs the way you do. I mean, I know it's very, very difficult songwriting, especially about your own experiences. It's very different to churning out a hit or a Christmas song where you're going to get the royalties. And it's a very personal thing. And I hope I didn't make you feel too uncomfortable about
the bones of it. You are, in a sense, bearing your soul anyway. You're sort of revealing a part of you, aren't you? I don't know how to explain it, but
I think it's a very brave thing for someone yourself to do, considering that people could listen to it and say things about you and about your music that could end up actually causing you emotional distress. But I think, and I hope, you've got the resilience that a lot of the young people that I've spoken to seem to have built up, that I was never really taught that's what other people think, and that's okay, but it doesn't change.
Everyone's gonna like you, and that's hard. I'm probably gonna make it worse for myself now, because anybody listening who doesn't my stuff, then they're gonna be like, ha, there's a chink in her armor.
Wow.
But I'm desperate. I find myself desperate to be liked by everyone if I can. I don't know why. I don't know if it's, I don't know. But
it's your emotional need for approval, acceptance. Yeah. And I think that comes when you are a sensitive and emotive person.
And but I think it's why,
we wouldn't have your music without you being a sensitive and emotive person. No, so that's what's lovely about it.
When you're releasing music and you're going out and playing music and whatever, obviously you're very much hoping, whether people do it politely or it comes from an authentic place, people will applaud and hear it. And it's kind of, I think it is a really, what's the word? I don't know what the word is, but it's messed up almost, that I think, and I think, don't think I songwriter and a musician and performer or creative person, you're putting stuff out there and you want people to get. Not everyone's going to get. I've had people tell me before, they don't like stuff. They think all my songs sound the same, whatever, they don't get. That's fine. It is. You get used to it. The first couple of times it is upsetting, but I'm not saying everybody thinks I'm wonderful, because not everybody does, but the people who have bought a ticket to come and see me play, mm-hmm. most likely, unless they have just bought a ticket to come and throw food at me and abuse me, most likely they've spent that money because they want to come and see me play. So if there's one guy in the room who doesn't get and says, oh, you're shit and I don't like your music and whatever, fine. That's fine. Mm. I wish it was an extra person in my music. That would be great, because there's one extra person in my music, but it's fine. And that's kind of as is life. Not everybody. Yeah. And that's hard. It's hard for some people to accept. It's definitely hard for me to accept, but I accept it.
Yeah. That's brilliant. My mummy hat says build your resilience, because I would hate for you to be knocked back and your career for you to feel you couldn't continue with your career, because it's hard. It's really hard out there.
It's really tough.
But I've said this many times before, life is hard, and you've got to learn and grow and keep moving forward if possible. And if you can't, you ask somebody to help you. But resilience, I think, is going to be so important for you. I just hope that you can continue sharing, because what I've heard, Sam, really, really enjoying. And I hope that the listeners have heard enough to go, oh, okay, there's a lot of meaning. There's a lot of emotion in your music, and to stream it or to buy it. Do you have an album out? I don't know how it works.
No, I don't. No. no, I don't have an album, because I've got a nice little following, but I don't feel at the moment in sort of this current climate and this day and age when there's so much sort of this instant gratification thing. Yeah. I think a lot of people, where I'm at right now, I don't have a big enough following for people to buy an album and actually listen to all of it.
Yeah.
I feel putting that much work into, let's say, 10 songs or whatever, at this point, I'd rather just release bit by bit and sort of trickle it out and hopefully increase.
And let people catch on.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think all of that, the way, that's another conversation, but the way that music is released now is so different, even 10 years ago, but let alone.
It's unrecognisable to what I remember, so I wouldn't even try to understand it.
I still buy CDs all the time. I love having CDs, but I think that's the musician in me. I think just appreciating it in a different way, maybe. I don't know, but yeah.
I've always loved the little sleeves with the lyrics on, because the days of Google, that's how you worked it out on the piano.
Yeah, exactly. Had lyrics, and also I'm really nosy, so I love reading the thank yous.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why, I just do. Really enjoy it. Terribly nosy. Yeah.
Oh, well, it's been really lovely chatting with you.
Thank you so much.
So that was the lovely Ellie, known as Redwood. Look her up. She's got stuff on YouTube and on various other platforms. I'm a Spotify person myself, but obviously it's widely available. And remember, if there's anything that we've spoken about in the podcast this week that's maybe stirred some feelings in yourself that you're worried about, remember, there's always help out there. There is help out there, and it's not used to be. If you are in crisis, or if you are needing immediate help, please speak with the emergency services. But on any other issues, just call the Lynx Mental Health Helpline. They're 24/7. They're there all day, all night. And you don't have to be in crisis. If there's just something on your mind, you need someone to talk to, that number is 0800 00 14 33 331. Sorry. So that's 0800 00 14 331. Any time, night or day. And if this podcast has made you think about anything positively, or made any changes to the way you think, or how you might be living your life,
then please leave us a voice message using the link in the episode below. We'd really love to hear from you. Now I'm going to leave you with one of Redwood's song that we mentioned that is very, very important and rung a lot of bells with me, and I hope it does the same for you. Thank you for another week. Goodbye.
Another day, another warning for bad weather. Another night alone, you can find me hardly holding it together. It's all my doing, it's all my useless. Do you know what it's like? Staring at the person before me. Another night alone. You can find me. You don't want me. It's all my doing. It's all my useless. Tonight.